Marketing is moving faster than ever. AI is everywhere, automation is everywhere, yet somehow the buyer keeps getting forgotten.
I feel like everyone is so full of fear and chasing this AI high and trying to automate the crap out of everything. And I just feel like they've completely forgotten the buyer. Like they've completely forgotten who's on the other end of the table receiving that thing. Maybe if you're selling to RevOps, they might be doing a lot of searching on, you know, LLMs, but if you're serving a buyer that's perhaps more traditional, they might be searching on Bing. You never know.
Oh, shout out to Bing.
Yeah, you just described Sylvie, so that's all she uses. But you had a really great observation on like the content that's working today, that basically it's either super raw or super polished. And that basically everything in the middle is invisible.
I think the middle is cursed for the same reason that, you know, what's rare is so valuable, what's commoditized is not. Because I think that middle is easier to create than ever.
Our guest today, Sylvia Lapointeven, has been the first marketer at three companies that grew massively. And she's seen what actually works when you stop chasing playbooks and start trusting judgment. So for all my marketers out there who are feeling burnt out on the noise and wanting to slow things down just enough to decide what actually matters, this episode's for you. I'm Chris Savage, and this is Talking Too Loud. Well, hey, Sylvia, how are you?
I'm fantastic. I don't know if you can see my background, but it's absolutely gorgeous out here and just pumped to be here and do some loud talking with you.
That's amazing. You know, I thought that was just a virtual background. So congratulations on really being there.
It is real. It is real.
I have gotten that several times.
I'm not surprised. Welcome to Talking Too Loud. We're so excited that you're here today. And I'd love to start the show by hearing what has got you talking too loud.
I love this question. So the thing that I've really, really been ranting about a lot recently on LinkedIn and elsewhere and, you know, over drinks and two friends is I feel like everyone is so full of fear and chasing this AI high and trying to automate the crap out of everything. And I just feel like they've completely forgotten the buyer. Like they've completely forgotten who's on the other end of the table receiving that thing, or they've completely forgotten to like build from this place of understanding the buyer and building with the buyer first. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, that's what in marketing, that's all that we do. That's all that we care about. And I've noticed this like hype cycle trend on LinkedIn recently where everyone's trying to like game the bot comments. And I feel like we're getting to like an age of a bit more cynicism and probably some healthy skepticism about what AI can do. But at the end of the day, we all still feel afraid, right? Like we're all still worried that we're behind. We feel this need to like prove our humanity and our value. And I think that starts from a place of thinking about who's on the other side of the table or the ad or the piece of content rather than thinking about ourselves.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I'm seeing the same exact thing. And it is interesting because it seems like there is, you know, what you see as an early adopter and then what you see is like if you're in the early majority or late majority, right? So there's this idea of like this adoption curve of technology and the things that early adopters care about are often, they'll find a product and they'll figure out how to use it. But in early majority, you have to say, here's my product, let me tell you how it's going to help you. And the early adopters are willing to deal with bugs, early majority isn't. And I feel like what's kind of happening is this huge whiplash back to like, hey, everything's like new for early adopters. But the early majority is still sitting there being like, well, I'm not going to use this if it has bugs, or I can't figure out. I've got a million things on my plate. How am I supposed to figure out how I'm supposed to use this new crazy thing? And it does feel like a particularly challenging movement to live between this kind of, you know, hype cycle and the hype being real in many cases and also completely not being real. And it's hard to piece through that. How do you think people should be doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the places that I've really seen this coming up is in communities. It's in like the backroom conversations. I think that's the only place I see people really being able to get honest about what they're actually doing that's actually valuable.
Not because, on social media, but when they talk to actual other people they know about what's actually working or not.
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel like I'm seeing this like resurgence of community, people wanting to connect with their peers or professional development or whatever you might call it. But it's generally in the back rooms. And the conversations about what's really happening or the value that they're really driving or what they're learning or practicing in. And I sometimes I ask people, what are you learning or testing out right now? And they're almost afraid to answer. Mm. They're like, oh, they're almost embarrassed to answer because they feel so far behind everyone else.
Yeah.
I feel like on the like public platforms, everyone's just doing a whole lot of posturing. Again, there is some real stuff in there. But I think the real advice I'm seeing tends to happen in the closed door rooms rather than the public places where people feel like they have to have it all figured out.
How much do you think the like the because it makes sense that there's a lot of FOMO, right? We see these like especially if you've been in SaaS for a while, we've gotten used to what good looks like and what great looks like. Oh, you're like a rule of 40 business, like. You're growing 40%, EBITDA flat. You're great. You're growing 20%, EBITDA 20%. You're great, right? And now, wait a second. There's AI companies left and right that it feels like 2 years they went from zero to 100 million revenue, zero to 200 million. It's like, oh my God, I have to do what they're doing. But it does seem like that is driven by the products themselves and able to just have unbelievable product market fit because they're literally solving a problem that couldn't be solved before. Versus, I could be wrong, but like in most cases, it doesn't seem like wild, crazy new forms of marketing, crazy growth hacks that no one's ever seen before. Do you see that same thing? Like, how do you look at that?
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I think the spike in AI usage and the increase in growth of those companies is in a big part due to people wanting to achieve the silver bullet. And I think we're at a stage now where a lot of people are learning, oh, that doesn't necessarily exist packaged up nicely in one solution or one tool. I don't necessarily see a lot of innovation on brand new ways to market, if that makes sense. Brand new ways to reach that person at the on the other side of the table. The fundamentals, I think, are much more similar than they used to be. Even as an example, a lot of people talking about AEO or whatever acronym we're calling it this week, LLMO. We really need to land on one.
ABCD.
We got more.
YOLO.
ChatGPT-ing or something? Okay.
But even that, it's like when I see real stats from companies about what percentage are actually, you know, business, what percent of business is actually coming from AEO, it tends to be still reasonably low. And I think the death of classic SEO has been greatly exaggerated because that's I also think
clipped.
I think the death of SEO is greatly exaggerated because so many people still are searching on Google, and yes, we all want to jump on the new trend and reach people in this new place where they are searching, and that is real and true. But it's not as dramatic as, you know, the LinkedIn posturing might make it appear. And I think a lot of the fundamentals of SEO still really matter. And it also depends, again, on your buyer, who's on the other side of the table. In maybe if you're selling to, you know, RevOps, they might be doing a lot of searching on, you know, LLMs. But if you're serving a buyer that's perhaps more traditional or isn't necessarily that, you know, cutting edge, leading edge person that's going to be using the AI browsers and so on, they might be searching on Bing. You never know.
Oh, shout out to Bing.
Yeah. You just described Sylvie. So that's all she uses.
I'm not a Bing gal, I respect, I respect the Bing homies of the universe. But I think that, you know, this kind of goes back to exactly what you were saying at the beginning. Like, you have to kind of meet the buyer where they're at. Like, what does it mean to like actually build and sell with the buyer in mind?
Yeah. So I think what it means to me to build with the buyer first is that anyone who is close to your buyer within the company is heavily involved in marketing. So at my current company, our CEO, for example, you know, he was in the space for many years. He's done that job. And so he's an excellent resource for us in terms of how to build for that buyer. At my previous company, we had our SEs were all former, you know, people that had been in our buyer's shoes. And so they were involved in marketing at every step of the way. And so I think there's a responsibility we have to involve non-marketing folks at the company who have been in the buyer's shoes and involve them in everything that we do. And one really cool example that I did was I ran this event called Marketing Shark Tank. It was a few months ago. And so the Shark Tank marketing team came up with all of their coolest, craziest ideas and pitched them. But the important part of it was that the panel of sharks were all representing our buyer personas. And they were all people that had done that job. And so those were the people giving us advice on what plays we should make. Because at the end of the day, who cares what the executive team thinks we should do? What really matters is what is going to land and resonate with the buyer. And so that was both a fun and interesting and cool way to, you know, put our craziest ideas out there, but also make sure that the folks that were judging them were coming from a place of having been in the buyer's shoes. And that was incredibly impactful to the team, even just our sense of purpose. We felt like we were more connected to the person on the other side of the table by doing that exercise.
That's super cool.
Yeah. And I want to go to like kind of earlier back a little bit, because I also don't want us to skip some things that I really want to ask you about, which is like, so you just joined a new company. You're coming in, CMO. Congratulations at Juno.
Thank you.
You know, not everyone's doing that every day. So what are the first things when you get in there? Like, what are you doing? Like, what's someone doing today who's coming into this role, coming into a company, figuring out like, okay, I'm going to, yeah, just walk us through it. Cause like we're talking about the things that are changing and the things that aren't. And I feel like this is like a very cool thing to dive into for anyone who's getting a new job or somebody who's actually, they're trying to take a step back and reevaluate how they work day to day.
It's like you're putting yourself in our listeners' shoes.
Yeah. I love that question because I think a lot of people right now feel like they're almost starting over because like we described, so much in the world is changing and starting at a new company is almost like a microcosm of the way we all feel like we're starting over at the moment. And so what I did when I joined, the very first thing is just align to the business, talk to the main stakeholders. And the important part of this is like ship something helpful on week one. And so in our case, it was a sales deck specifically for our larger deals that we were just getting into. We were selling more of those and we needed a story for them. And so that was the first thing that really rose to the surface is like, okay, I can ship this thing and add value on day one. And so I think it's important to align to the business instead of me coming in with all my fancy, shiny playbooks that I want to roll out, just ship something helpful on week one. And plus, it just allows you to roll up your sleeves. I had to learn the buyer in order to create that story. And so I was already in there listening to sales calls, analyzing those transcripts, understanding that buyer so that I could create that story. And I just was able to ship something really helpful on week one. And then the second thing I did was really getting into the product. I think if there's a marketer at any company that just literally hasn't logged in and poked around and done some of those exercises, it's like, you know, if you're working at a SaaS company, it could be different for, you know, services, other types of businesses, but how can you experience the product like a customer would? And we had this big product launch the second week that I joined. And so I was like, I'm going to get in there. I'm going to take all the visuals, the product visuals. I'm going to write that product release update. I was like making GIFs where I was dragging documents in and showing the result. And that was such a great exercise for people like, okay, now I know my way around the product. Yeah. And then of course, just finding those people internally that know the buyer really well and asking them a lot of questions. So like going to the source and really learning about the buyer from the people internally, as well as things like the sales call transcripts and Reddit. Reddit is a fantastic resource, by the way, especially if you want to do anything with humor. it is incredible to spark some very fun ideas because...
Have you been doing a lot there?
I will be. Well. Not yet. No, we actually have a big brainstorm humor session next week to get into that. Okay. I think humor is really, really powerful because, I mean, talk about a way to connect with a buyer. You have to understand someone really well to know what's going to be funny to them. And it's also really scary because it might not land. It might make them angry. It might, it might piss them
humor
off.
Humor is, it is scary, actually.
Yeah. I think it's hard. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do because it's so subjective. And Chris, you and I have talked about that on the show before.
Oh, like, yeah. Well, like, so you make a joke and it doesn't land.
And it doesn't,
it's one thing if it's like in a conversation.
Yeah.
And it's another thing if it's like you're paying to put that joke in front of others.
Like a brand ad. That's just like, no.
Yeah. But I think my big philosophy on this is that anything that's rare is going to be more valuable than ever. And anything that's commoditized, especially with everything that's easier to automate with AI, is going to become less valuable. It's going to be easily automatable and it'll be commoditized. It won't be as valuable. And I think humor is one of those things that is rare because people are afraid of it. So when you do it, you can stand out.
The bots aren't very good at humor yet.
Yeah. That is definitely true.
We've talked a lot about the scarcity, the importance of humans, like also that trust is going to be more important, knowing that you're talking to a real person. Like, what are the other things that you think are going to be more rare in the world that we're in today? And like, let's say just like 3 years in the future, what do you think is going to be more rare?
I mean, in-person events, absolutely. That's a rare thing, being able to be physically with someone face-to-face. And I think events, my prediction for events is the most valuable events will be the ones that are either like a workshop style, you are rolling up your sleeves and you bring your laptop and you're doing stuff, or it's going to be more experiential. It's going to be something where, you know, you're creating an experience and it's not your classic, you know, happy hour, or it's not as predictable. It's something that's an experience in and of itself. I'm seeing a lot more retreats. I'm seeing a lot more just non-traditional venues, non-traditional speakers. And I think that's going to be, you know, again, that stands out. It takes effort. It's manual. That's not easily automated. And I think because of that, it's going to be more valuable.
Yeah, anything that obviously has work involved, basically. Yeah.
Another thing is anything around ecosystem marketing. So activating your customers, activating your partners, your power users. That is something, that personal relationship, whether it's influencer marketing or whether it's partnerships, there is a level of personal relationship that's required for those things to work well. And because of that, it's also not automatable. Some components of it are, of course, but I think ecosystem marketing is going to be more important than ever because there's a lot of skepticism out there right now. I think it allows you to like leapfrog years of trust and be able to break through all that noise. And again, it's rare because it's hard and manual. And I think because of that, it'll be really valuable.
You've also talked about putting marketers into two buckets, this like tastemakers and operators. Can you break down those roles for us and like why are both important?
Yeah. So it's funny. I know Emily Kramer has this concept of the gen marketer, which is kind of the person that can do it all. It's more on the operator side of the spectrum, I would say. But I've really found that folks tend to fall into one or the other bucket. And the tastemaker is the person who, they love the story. They love the design. They love the experience. Maybe they have like a journalism background, or they write on the side, or they, you know, love to paint for fun. I don't know, anything in that creative world where they know what good looks like. And then the operators tend to be obsessed with systems. Like you can give them a pile of disconnected, fragmented systems and they can turn it into an absolute engine. And that's incredibly valuable as well. And so I think when you can pair both of those skill sets together, you get something really incredible. And it's not like you have to be all one or the other, but I do think it's kind of an 80-20 situation where folks are inevitably going to gravitate towards one or the other.
Totally. Do you think that a tastemaker puts the buyer in mind more than an operator.
Wow. I think trying to get yourself in there, huh?
Uh-oh.
Do you think that I'm better than others?
No, no. I never said I was a tastemaker.
I'm a very creative person.
I never said I was a tastemaker, although I think I am.
I think there's also two ways to really understand the buyer really well. You can do it quantitatively or qualitatively. And so perhaps the tastemaker is better at that qualitative view where, you know, there's insights you'll get from sitting and watching a sales call than you will just not get from any magic transcript analysis engine in the world.
Totally.
And so I think there's value to that qualitative side. And then the quantitative side is also valuable. Like, sure, this great insight might have come up, but how many times does that insight or that problem come up? And so I think you need both. And I think they can both bring different strengths to the table in the understanding the buyer category.
No, I think that's a really good point. I think when I started at Wistia, I was totally green to marketing. Like, I did not know. And so, like, I was coming in with like a background and story. And I think, like, over the years, I have learned the value of data. Like, data used to really scare me.
Wow.
I know. Big reveal.
Big admission here.
This is a great therapy session right here. Yeah, now. Yeah, yeah.
That's what I needed.
I was
guys.
Just so afraid of data.
No, but in some ways, I feel like because there is this like divide, and I don't mean to perpetuate it. Like, I think like I was very comfortable just staying in story as a marketer. And Chris, I think you actually bridge both. Like, I think you have taste maker and operator, and you were very like numbers curious. Mm. And like, I see how that can really lend itself. It can lend itself to being a better storyteller, ultimately, I guess is what I'm trying to say in a very long.
Yeah. Are you kind of saying like
confessional
how
way.
Important do you think it is that these people can do the other thing?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, how important is it that they like try to nurture the other thing? If it is like a true 80-20, how important is it that they kind of exercise that 20 muscle?
I mean, I think it depends on your current team setup. And do you want to be like, my background is 0-1 marketing. I've been the first marketing hire. Now this will be my fourth time at a very early marketing hire at an early stage company, building from scratch. To do that job, you have to be able to do both. But if your taste is and your preferences are more for a larger company with a more, you know, multidimensional team, then you can probably lean on other folks to fill the gap in that, whatever the opposite side is. Totally. But I do think the tastemaker operator framework is somewhat at odds with ownership of something end to end, which I do think AI can help teams own end-to-end an area more than they could before.
For sure.
If you're not, you know, a skilled designer, skilled motion, or skilled at, you know, content production, workflows, et cetera, I think you can lean on some of the latest technology to help fill that gap. And I think one of the most challenging parts of marketing is how many handoffs there are. It's like this assembly line where, you know, strategy goes to copywriting, goes to design, and oftentimes you kind of lose a lot of the soul along the way on the assembly line. And so I think there's such power in being able to give one person the ability to own something end to end from origination to delivery and have AI fill some of the skill gaps that maybe they couldn't have done that before. Mm-hmm. That said, I do think there will be times where part of that assembly line is more tastemaker and part of that assembly line is more operator. And you might need some handoffs in there. But at the end of the day, I'm hoping there can be somewhat fewer and that work can move faster, but more importantly, keep its soul along the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that end to end is more like similar to Emily Kramer's like gen marketer. Like, they should be able to essentially do it all.
Exactly. I just think work will move a lot faster that way and you'll preserve the original intention. And plus, it's just like really satisfying for someone to be able to ship something and say like, I did that. And that's how I feel about just my whole career journey. This is why I started early stage companies. People always think I'm crazy. Like my last company, I grew from employee number 4 to like 300. We were $850 million valuation. And then I jumped back into a startup that was, you know, pre-Series A. And so I just love that because it's so fulfilling to look back and say, like, I helped create that from nothing. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, like we're all looking for some meaning, I think, in our work, especially right now. And it's really meaningful to be able to do that end to end.
Yeah. That's very badass. What do you look for in those early companies? Because like, obviously, like you're going to get in there, you're going to market the hell out of it. You're going to get people to care about it. You're going to tell them about it. But like, if the product sucks, like, guess what? There's going to have a ton of cancellations. It's not going to work. The model just breaks. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing to get into because
very true.
People are always trying to figure out like what's coming next. How do you know what's coming next? Like what draws you to these very early stage companies and what turns you off from them? What do you see? And you're like, hell no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been super early stage now 3 times and all 3 companies have done really well. One of them exited, was acquired by Oracle, and the other 2 are valued at over $2 billion combined now. And the most common thread that I've noticed in going 0 to 1 several times at these startups that have done very well is that the founder has come from the space. They weren't necessarily somebody who wanted to be a founder. They just were in a space where they had felt so much pain and they couldn't not solve the problem. And so they almost reluctantly became a founder to solve that problem that they were so deeply familiar with and had literally felt that pain themselves. And I just think that gives you such an advantage because you know what to build, you know what's going to delight people, you know what problem you're solving, you have the stories to back it up. You can talk to those early customers like you've been in their shoes. And I do think that that's been a common thread in the companies that have done well. And I think that's always something that I look for in any new career move, because it is hard to tell early on, is this company going to make it? But that's the main thing that I've noticed that's really stood out.
This should inspire anyone who's in pain right now. You know, go. True. Start a company.
If figure you're in a out lot of pain. That's what this is really about. Pain. Yeah, but it's back to what you're talking about before of like they understand the buyer, they actually understand the problem. They know the problem's real too, right? Like there's a lot of companies that get started with like a idea of something and they're guessing at a problem. And it's like these people know there's a problem. And so that's one of the key things you're looking for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And like they obviously have never probably marketed and thought about like, how do I take that story and tell it? And that's like a thing you zero in on. Which also gets me to another question I want to just dig in on, which I thought you had a really great observation on like the content that's working today, that basically it's either super raw or super polished. And that basically everything in the middle is invisible. So my question is,
this is like so the way you're asking.
Why is the middle so cursed?
Why is the middle cursed? Well, I think the middle is cursed for the same reason that, you know, what's rare is so valuable, what's commoditized is not. Because I think that middle is easier to create than ever. And I think this is why we're seeing this like strong insurgence on both sides of, you know, the tastemaker roles of, you know, the CEO content writer that's being very well paid. And then we're seeing these roles of, you know, the go-to-market engineer who's automating everything. I think it's similar with content where, you know, the middle is so easy to automate that it's becoming less valuable than ever. And I think unique, you know, highly produced, maybe it's deep original research, which is also a topic I'm really excited about that a lot of companies I'm seeing do really well. That type of content is going to stand out and be incredibly valuable. And the content that's super raw, like when I go on LinkedIn right now, I see people misspelling stuff on purpose and not using punctuation and just ranting literally just to prove that they're human. And so yeah. I think the raw side is just like, people are so craving that right now because they're so tired of the, you know, polished, wrinkle-free, error-free.
Doesn't say anything at all. Yeah.
It seems like that should be freeing. And I think for some people it is, but kind of like you were saying before about like people being embarrassed to kind of answer like where they are on their AI journey or like what's in their tech stack. It should be like the idea of it sounds so freeing, even though I think it's harder in practice. Like,
yeah. And to be honest, that's the spot I'm in right now too, because I love posting. You know, I'm probably most marketers, like we're perfectionists. We love things that are polished and beautiful. And it is really hard to post something that feels unfinished or unresolved, or just say, I'm having this challenge and I haven't figured it out yet. I haven't solved it. And so, yeah, that's the point I'm in right now too. I'm wondering how might I bring a little bit more rawness to it while still adding value and sharing what I'm learning, but not needing it to, you know, be the perfect answer all the time either.
No, like, totally.
I'm sure a lot of people are feeling that way. You know, how do I be more vulnerable? I think
it's hard if you have any existing brand. I feel like it's easier if you don't have a brand because you don't have anything to lose. But if you've, especially if you're like a, we'll keep it on SaaS, but like if you're a SaaS business, you've built up a brand over a long time, it's hyper polished. Now I'm going to tell you, hey, take this risk with your brand equity and like start putting like mistakes in to what you write and start showing people on casts. Like, I think they're going to be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But you know, what's funny is you're talking, it also has me thinking, like, I feel like what I keep seeing is companies that have people representing them that actually do both. And that's the flex. The flex is like, oh yeah, here's my super raw thinking on this thing. Maybe totally incorrect, but at least I'm willing to put out there. And like, here's my hot take. And then the next day, launch like a Super Bowl commercial. Mm-hmm. And it's like so good. And it has like incredible actors in it. And you're like, what is going on? Like, you're literally doing both. And that it makes it even more, it's like better than just one or the other, you know? It's like, oh yeah, we got taste and polish and we're super raw and real and human. What do you think about that? You like that?
Yeah.
And it's like, then like that's a brand that can represent people, and also the quality of what we produce is so high that probably our products and services are that great too.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. And I like to call this like the brand and the faces behind the brand, because the brand is the front facing website, Super Bowl ad side of the brand. But then you can also have this faces behind the brand side of it, where the people at your company get to provide that rawness, because I think that that rawness can't come from a company brand necessarily. I think it has to come from a human. That's, you know, inherent in its nature. Yeah. But I think so you can absolutely balance those things, and you can have one brand that's hyper polished and high production, have so much fun with that, and then I think you can also bring the raw side of it as well. But I agree, if you have a personal brand that's polished, how do you step into rawness? I think that's a really interesting question.
That is hard. I think that pivot is hard. Yeah,
you know, it's, I can, for me, it changed when we started doing the podcast. Because I used to post on Twitter back in the day all the time. And like the stuff I was posting was usually pretty polished. It's like, oh, here's this update from Wistia of something that we did. Here's my thoughts. This thing was really well thought out. As, and I'm not saying it's because it's so good, because I spent so long on it and it was like written on the blog and it's like very, 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 very polished. And I remember thinking I have this image of who people think I am. And then eventually the podcast just took all the walls. I was like, well, I can't really hide any of this. Like it's all there. And I actually found it incredibly freeing. And I found it freeing, like, you know, publicly when I share things. And I honestly found it freeing internally too, where suddenly I was like, well, I'm so myself on this podcast because it would just be too tiring otherwise.
Yeah.
That I'm like actually willing to comment way more raw stuff all across Slack and in the business. So I see people in person where I did that in the early days. And then I felt as we got bigger and been doing this longer that it was like, should I do this anymore? Like, am I even in the place to do it? It was like a very interesting transition of just like the medium, I think, forced the authenticity. And then that was so freeing. And then that worked.
And the authenticity then builds trust.
So it all was like a cycle. Yeah.
That's interesting. Cool. I had a similar experience when I first started doing podcasts, which was maybe just over a year ago. And I realized the exact same thing. And so maybe there's something about that medium of a podcast that's long form. You can afford to be nuanced and explore and be curious. And yeah, maybe that for me, like doing podcasts for me, unlocked posting on LinkedIn for me, because I was terrified to post on LinkedIn, which I think a lot of people are. I get comments from people all the time about like, help, I want to, but I'm so afraid. And honestly, that whole journey of podcasts and LinkedIn like changed my life, changed how I show up in my work.
Wow.
Because it allowed me to really crystallize what I believe.
Mm.
Because I didn't necessarily have to do that as much. Like, it was my job before to just show up and have the right answers and have a plan. And that's what I felt like my job was. And as I started exploring and talking to people and asking questions in these mediums that just were more curious, it actually led me to more clarity because I found what I did believe in. And that, yeah, it's honestly changed my whole experience of being a CMO, because now I can crystallize my beliefs, and that drives everything else.
That's wild.
That's awesome. It's so cool you're sharing that. And I think, like, you know, I've heard that with people talking about writing too, of like, you just need to write and then you'll figure out what you think. And it's like, what? That doesn't sound like that makes sense.
What in the riddle is that?
It's so true. Cause like, you're on podcasts, there's no plan. We're just talking. We don't know where we're going. Like, I mean,
some
of us do, but the, I think coming into it, it's also like knowing you're being recorded, I think sometimes causes your brain, at least I'll speak for myself, like to go on like a different level of like making connections. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I come out of a podcast like, oh, wow, I've never said that like that before. And that felt way better and easier. So like I write that down and then go use it in other places. So it is a very interesting thing, because it's also just like the thing I tell myself too is like, you're on a podcast, you're being yourself. Guess what? All these people around you, they know you. Like if you're meeting with them in person, you're having lunch with them, like they know you, they even know your imperfections and they still like you. And like, that's fine. And I think that's a hard thing to come to terms with, is like, I'm gonna put my whole self out there and I may say something that people don't like or disagree with or like actively hate. And that's actually okay. And that we can give each other grace, but that's not what traditional, highly polished brand marketing feels like, right? It's like we don't go into that assuming everyone's going to give us grace on the marketing we do, but the human side, they are.
It's so funny. It was such a step up, I think, it just my maturity as a leader. And the example that's coming to mind is board meetings. Like the early days of board meetings, I would rehearse the hell out of every talking point, right? Yeah. And then as the years went on, I just show up. Mm-hmm. Because I realized what they want, and I think this is true for everyone, is people want to feel you. They want to see that authentic reaction and explanation and thought process and curiosity. And if you don't have that, you actually come across very one-dimensional and less believable. So it's this ironic twist of...
it's so funny. You know, you made me think of, we were interviewing someone for a role once. And we had a bunch of great candidates and we're trying to pick between them. It was like the final round and somebody came in and they're like, yep, here's my, they had done a project. Like, here's the plan. We're like, great. And then we had a bunch of questions for them and like, oh yeah, I've done something like that. And they didn't have they just started searching on their computer for like previous things they had done. And we're like, oh, do you need a minute to get your... They're like, no, don't worry. And they just were like, literally as if we were just like working together. And it was like one of the compelling things I had ever seen.
Yeah.
Because like this person can roll with anything. And they're just being themselves. That's all they were doing. But it was
They were like opening a closet in front of you and being
Let me just get my stuff. And then which of these do you like? Like, I've done this, I've done that, I've done this. And you're like... and then they take something out. They're like, I think like 60% of this is helpful and 40% we'll throw out. But this 60%, this part's really interesting. And it like dumbfounded everybody. We're like, and then they've been that exact person.
Yeah.
But it's exactly what you're saying in the board meeting of like, you know, people just want to actually see you and they want to know the truth. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you think is working? What do you think isn't? Like, why are we in the position we're in? And if it's too rehearsed, you actually can't get through to that. But that is the instinct.
Yeah. It was like the process of them showing you told you more about the person than actually the portfolio did.
Yeah.
Just them being willing to be like, let me just pull that up and be a little chaotic in this moment. But like, this is how I am. This is who you know,
it's
funny hiring. Too.
It's like, and that's back to the brand. It's the brand showing you, right? It's like if you see these raw people, but they're earnest and they're trying hard and they care, and then you like become a customer and you actually can have hopefully a similar experience. Like it's like a representation of the culture. Like that's great. That's awesome. Like I kind of knew what I was getting. And then also, if the product and service is really polished, just like all the polished parts of your marketing, then you're like, oh, this delivers on this. It's like kind of in a weird way, the whole package and like a signal. But I mean, talk about things we haven't really talked about. I feel like this is like, it's just very interesting because I had not thought about that in that way before, that's what you're representing, but it is kind of what you're doing.
It reminds me too about this whole trend of just people being more forward facing in brands as well. The faces behind the brand.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a similar thing. It's like, if you're going to bet on a company and you trust and feel like you know the people at that company, then you don't even need to test every aspect of the product. You're like, these are smart people. I believe them. I trust in them. And that makes me want to bet on it. So yeah, it's like, it's almost like the company showing you its personality the same way. That person in that interview showed you their character by being willing to explore. Mm-hmm. It's funny. I was at a CMO dinner recently and everyone was going around the table asking like, what's most important when you're hiring right now? And the hands down answer from everyone was creative problem solving. They were like, the skills, you know, polish, all this stuff, like wasn't really at the top of the list. It was a creative problem solving, maybe coming back to how everyone feels like they're at zero and we're all figuring it out together and everyone feels behind and a little afraid. They just want someone who can sit next to them and pull up some work and be curious and solve problems and solve problems creatively. I think that's such an important skill set right now.
Totally.
Yes. I don't know why I'm thinking of this, but have you ever seen the movie One Fine Day? With Michelle Pfeiffer and George Clooney.
You're like asking the worst person because I grew up in Africa my whole life and I didn't watch any movies because I grew up in the middle of nowhere. It's a long story.
That's more interesting than One Fine Day. So.
Got her. You got Sylvie good.
But yeah, I haven't seen any movies.
When did you move to the US?
I was 17. I moved to LA and I had been in Kenya and Mozambique. My parents are in nonprofit work. And so I actually think like that's a big part of my whole character and self is like, I've been an outsider my entire life. I was an outsider when I lived there. And then when I moved to the US, it was like, I looked like people here and I could pretend like I was from the US, but I absolutely was not. And so I just learned to fully embrace that. There's probably something in there for brands too.
You're doing
we don't even have to make the connection. I think everyone watching and listening understands completely.
What growing up in Africa taught me about B2B SaaS. That's
there you go. Clip it.
That's the title.
Yeah. thank you so much for being here. This is an amazing episode. Where can people connect with you? Like, where can they find you? Where can they learn more?
Yes, I'm very active on LinkedIn. Absolutely follow me. I love interacting with people, sharing. Again, it's been such a big part of my growth journey, myself personally. And then I do write a Substack called The 0-1 Marketer. And especially now that I'm newly a 0-1 marketer at a new company, I absolutely will be sharing everything that I'm learning along the way.
Amazing. Well, that was super fun.
So fun.
Super great.
A lot of giggling.
A lot of giggling. A lot of good times. A lot of insights.
A lot of marketing. Marketing takeaways.
But yes, with that, I want to say thank you again to Sylvia for being here with us today. Don't forget, if you want to stay up to date on not just Talking Too Loud, the podcast, but our newsletter, subscribe on wisdom.com. Look for Talking Too Loud. If you want this to show up on your TV, right next to all those clips of the Gran Turismo experts that you follow and the interesting home magicians who teach you how to do magic tricks yourself, subscribe to us on YouTube or wherever you watch or listen to podcasts. That's it. And we'll see you soon.
Talking Too Loud is brought to you by Wistia. Hosted by Chris Savage. Produced by me, Sylvie Lubow, along with Adam Day. Executive produced by Wistia Studios. This episode was mixed by Maria Passingham of Edit Audio. Listen to Talking Too Loud wherever you listen to podcasts. And hey, rate and review us wherever you listen. And check out more content from Wistia Studios at wistia.com.